Once more into the breach, dear friend.
Let's close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And now we're out of things to say.
I've got something to throw in here. It's a very general topic, but I think it's one you'll like.
Okay.
Cost of information and fake news. One of our favorites, collectively, the two bald people in the room, bearded bald people in the room, collectively have a favorite, or one of several favorites, Nobel Prize winning economists. The one in question here is Douglas North. He won the Nobel Prize because he effectively predicted the fall of the Soviet Union. He also effectively, not in specifics, but in generalities, predicted the Arab Spring.
1991, as I recall.
Yeah. So you might think he has some stuff to add to this. Fake news is something he predicted. Fake news in air quotes, if you will. He has a quote that we like to do. It's not very user friendly. The stability of any socioeconomic system is inversely proportional to the cost of information.
No, you get it backwards. The instability of any socioeconomics,
Right. I didn't say instability.
The instability of any socioeconomic institution is inversely proportional to the cost of information.
What does that mean? What it means is that as it's easier to produce information that lots of people can read, it lowers the stability of the region that that's happening in. You can think of the Gutenberg Press and the schism in the Catholic Church, the Protestant-Catholic split, happened because the Gutenberg Press was used to print the pamphlet. It became relatively cheap, and by relatively, I mean by today's standard, it was still really expensive, but compared to having a monk painstakingly handwrite every letter in a pamphlet for every pamphlet, this was a big, big jump in efficiency. It was a lot cheaper to do this. The cost of information dropped, and it destabilized the whole of Europe and into Eastern Europe, into Asia. It destabilized and didn't restabilize for many years afterwards. The internet lowered the cost of information. It used to be it cost a lot of money to have your pamphlet published so that other people could read it. With the internet, anybody can publish anything they want to. With the advent of cell phone cameras, you can take a video from your perspective for a short video that seems to encapsulate the entirety of the truth and post that. We saw this kerfluffle, I like to use that word, in D.C. over the Native American praying with a drum in front of a young man that was wearing a Make America Great Again hat. And it sure looked like from that video that this was aggression on the political spectrum, that these young men were somehow attacking this Native American. That doesn't look good. It doesn't really matter who you are. It doesn't look good. And then more video comes out that shows the whole of it, and it's much more of a misunderstanding, much more of you just got to see a smaller amount of the clip. You can see the same thing in cameras on police brutality. Is it really police brutality when we look at a body cam and it shows a very different perspective that has nothing to do with that other view? It destabilizes until we can get some standards out there of what is truth. Many of the reputable news sources covered this racist story in D.C. as if these kids were horrible kids, when the reality was that it really wasn't even what it looked like. The Native American was coming to calm a situation, and it looks like he did. It looks like he calmed it very well. And there was a bunch of other stuff going on in the background that there were people getting riled up, and it calmed down. So recognizing that news is easy to make now means that our standards for where we get our news need to be higher. Free news is not necessarily good news. And that what that says about CNN, I'm not sure, because they're available online for free. What it says about MSNBC, I don't know what that says. What it says about Fox News, I don't know. They're free. If you go through a paywall, at least you'll begin to understand the bias of the news organization. But it's not free. So the cost of information there, when it's a higher cost of information and people recognize it and hold it to a higher standard, obviously your money should go to the place that you believe has a higher standard in news. But also you should recognize that every news source has a bias. It's just different biases. But the number one bias that they all have is they want to be profitable. So keep that in mind in the middle of this. So cost of information and fake news, that's economic. It tends to have these big political shifts. This is your subject as much as mine, and I'm hoping that you can jump in and join in the middle of this. I thought this would be a good one to hand back and forth a little bit. It influences the stock market and the economy.
That is a key element, and is the people ask me why we have so much polarization in Congress and polarization going on around the world. And that's really the key, is, if you will. I don't particularly care for Prime Minister Erdogan of Turkey.
Right. Nor do I.
But he said something that was very accurate. He said the single most dangerous thing to any country today is Twitter.
Yeah. I mean, that's what the Arab Spring was. It wasn't a democratic movement. It was a flash mob.
As an example, in France right now, the Yellow Vests.
Another flash mob. No leaders.
Which has been rioting, got the claimed demands. In the past, the French rioters have stopped rioting at that point because they had a leader that told them when to start and when to stop. Well, the government's having a lot of trouble getting them to stop because, as Jake said, they don't have leaders. They have it is a mob. It is a mob, literally. And I read a long time ago, and I don't know if there's any deep study to back this up or not, but a mob, the intelligence of a mob can be determined by taking the average intelligence of the people involved and dividing them by the number of people involved. So if the average intelligence is, by definition, 100, IQ, I have 100, and there's 100 people in a mob, it will then have the same IQ as an amoeba, which is 1.
You'll appreciate whose quote you're doing there.
Whose quote am I doing?
Terry Pratchett.
Well, I like Terry Pratchett.
I do too. He's not somebody that did the studies, but man, he definitely has
great
an imaginative
writer.
Mind.
And anyway, the point is that as communication costs collapse, you have a choice. And your choice is to believe everything you hear because you saw it on the internet, or somebody else saw it on the internet and they posted it on Facebook.
Can I give you the whole quote? Because
okay.
It's worth it. The IQ of a mob is the IQ of its most stupid member divided by the number of mobsters.
Right.
Man, well, is that true?
Not
though?
The one I was thinking
it's
of.
It's very true.
He was misquoting somebody else, I think. But Terry Pratchett probably has a grasp on that issue. And it's really important because what happens, and Kahneman, I just read some Richard Kahneman on this, and it's certainly true.
Daniel
Kahneman, I'm sorry. When we hear something that confirms our prejudice, confirms our already assumed position, we believe it to be true automatically, and we will repeat it to somebody else who has the same prejudice, who had the same, already had their mind made up, and so they'll believe it too, and it'll pass around very, very quickly and reinforce something that may not be true at all. And it's hard to beat that. And if you're making personal decisions on it, then it's really even harder to beat that. You know, I know people who took a lot of money and dumped it into spec houses with the intent of flipping them. And when I asked them why they did that, they knew people who had told them how much money they made doing this and how much money could be made doing it. And they had read someplace about how much money could be made doing it. And the point is, it was that collapse in communication that caused this as much as anything else. If they had dug into it, they would have realized, because these are intelligent people, that the risk level here was phenomenally high. And by the way, I don't know anybody that made a lot of money flipping houses. I do know a number of people who lost a lot of money flipping houses. So you hear things, and it's really important to recognize that if you don't consciously, like Jake said, go through a paywall. In other words, we read the Wall Street Journal a lot. Why do we read the Wall Street Journal? And I don't listen to Fox a lot. I don't watch or listen to Fox. I don't listen to MSNBC. The free sites, by and large, have an audience to which they are...
Pandering is a good word, but it's an echo chamber.
But it's a pandering. In other words, they have certain people who will watch their show if they confirm their prejudices, even if what they present is not the whole truth. Even if it's only part of the truth, and it's only part of the truth that reinforces the people who are listening. On the other hand, if you go someplace where you have to pay, and you feel the weight of paying, the people who put that publication together are generally speaking, not always.
Boy, it's true, not always. I mean, New York Times definitely has a political bias.
They do.
The Washington Post has a different bias. It's not as political, except some of the political figures.
But that's why we use the Wall Street. That's why I use, when it comes to the stock market, I use Morningstar a lot. I use Morningstar because you got to pay. I don't use the free version, by the way. And when we go to look for factual information, it's a really good idea to find some place where you have to pay for it. And I, by the way, I make a point of not reposting anything that I see that I get on any free site. If I get an email from somebody, or if I go to Facebook and see something that confirms some prejudice I have, I make a point of not reposting it, because so many times I've gone back and found out that it's false information. It's hard. There's a reverse to that, though. Douglas North not only said that as information costs drop, we will see things destabilize and polarize. He also said that property rights,
right, this is the strength,
offset that.
This is the strength to the weakness of information costs.
And if you happen to be listening to this and you live in the state of Texas, you live in the nation with the highest property rights in the world, and in the state in that nation with the highest property rights in the world, which is one of the reasons that you may or may not like the way the government works in the state of Texas. But stability, unstable is something it is not.
Yeah.
And when we look at the places where instability grows and is growing, it's places where property rights are particularly weak. And the government has the right to step in and take your property away from you, or some land baron, some rich person has the right to come and take the stock, your property away from you, in fact. So it's one of those things where it's the best of times is the worst of times. You know, I said this when we wrote the newsletter this week. We may be in the United States, and probably are, leveling off, so that we've gone from a period of 9 years of pretty good growth to a level period that probably will be followed by a downturn. A small, relatively small downturn, but a downturn, because they come. Europe is teetering on the edge of recession. Italy officially enters into recession with two quarters of down,
yeah.
Although we don't have an official read on that yet.
I would call it a recession at this point. It meets the definition.
Germany probably will dodge the bullet by a tenth or less of 1%. Of being in recession, and the entire European Union is at risk of falling into recession at any time. Growth in China is slowing, and domestic consumption, which is what they were depending on to offset the export falls, is slowing right now because the people there are concerned. What they're trying to do is pull down a huge debt bubble that they've got in China. The rest of the world has problems that make our worst-case scenario look pretty good. We live in a nation that is with a stable government, where we have democratically elected officials. And you may not like the democratically elected official, but the institution still supports them. We are stressing our system tremendously to the point that it would cause a collapse of any other government I know of. But we are not, for example, in the position where they face in, 30 days? How many days till Brexit?
It's coming up February, I think. It's the end of February.
Okay. Sometime in March, maybe it's at the end of March, Brexit kicks in. And based on what they've got worked out so far, a lot of vital medications and food will no longer be imported into Great Britain at that point, in the United Kingdom at that point. And, you know, we think we got some problems. We don't have any problems compared with what we're seeing across Europe right now. We don't have any problems compared with what is occurring in the rest of the world. So
it's March 29, yeah.
Look on the upside and recognize that we are going through a stressful period. We're liable, it looks to me like, to see further stress over the next few years. But I will also say this, and I think it's important to make this very, very clear. The 2020s are coming.
Yeah, that is pretty clear. It's a good. That is a fantastic prediction, right, by the way. And you can write this down. See if he's wrong on that one.
I'm going to make the prediction that the 2020s will be a boom decade that will economic growth in the 2020s will exceed any other decade we have ever seen in U.S. history. Now, I can't make any guarantees about that, obviously, but everything I see coming down the road says our productivity growth, which has been stagnant for a long time, relatively stagnant, growing at 1% to 2% a year, will zoom. Our dominance in the world will accelerate. Our economic health will take off like a rocket ship, and you just have to be patient and wait to get there. And we have a caller on 254-773-1400. So, caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach.
Yes, sir. Thank you. I was going to ask you a question concerning the military and it's going overseas protecting other people's borders. You know, this costs plenty of money, you know, for these people to be out there. Who's funding the money? And why is it that they want everybody in the United States military or armed forces to come and protect their country, and we're having a debate and issue of putting a wall up to protect our country? You have a good day, sir.
All right. That's a
deep question.
Deep question, not as economic as we like to deal with, but we can touch it. A lot of the countries that we have military bases in, Japan, the Philippines, Germany, pay us to be there. They pay us not as much as it costs, but the stability from having our armed forces there increases our trade. It keeps wars from happening. We're not in danger of a war with Mexico right now.
The United States established a foreign policy following World War II. Prior to World War II, we did not have bases overseas except in areas where we had colonies. And we wound up with a war that killed millions of Americans, following another war that killed a lot of Americans. These wars started in far-off places, but because of the nature of technology today, they spread quickly to the United States. We have troops in Afghanistan and Syria and Iran simply because of 9/11. The United States was attacked, and we don't want to give a terrorist organization a nation from which to launch an attack on the United States. So we have to keep fighting not just Al-Qaeda, but perhaps the Taliban, and certainly ISIS, because there's no question that if they were given free rein to establish a base in a country like Al-Qaeda had in the beginning of this century, they would arrange an attack on the United States. So we have a choice, and the foreign policy choice is very simple. We either fight our enemies overseas, or we wind up fighting them here at Pearl Harbor or in New York City. And we made a very good choice, in my opinion, to fight them overseas. The second reason that we do what we do is, even though the United States only has 12% exports, and a larger percent of our GDP is imports, we are literally dependent upon world trade flowing smoothly. And there are places in the world where, were it not for the United States Navy and the presence of the United States military, things would destabilize and we could no longer do vital trade that the United States economy depends on. We made a choice to continue to protect the freedom of the seas. We made a choice to say we are not going to allow any despotic power like Russia or China to grow large enough to where they can threaten the United States, because it's just a heck of a lot more efficient to keep them from expanding from their current position than it is to wait till they take over Europe or Southeast Asia or whatever and then attack the United States, because ultimately they would. And I think that's a wise move. It is a little scary when I hear the president suggest that he would no longer defend under the NATO treaty, because the reason Europe has gone for over half a century now without a major war, the last two of which drug us in and millions of Americans were killed, the reason they've gone without a war for this long is really one reason. The United States has troops stationed in Europe, stationed around Europe, so that if the Russia, I almost said Soviet Union, if Russia attacked, they'd have to kill Americans and we'd get involved. And that's the only reason there's been peace there. The only reason Taiwan has not been invaded. The only reason there hasn't been a major war in Southeast Asia and in the Pacific is because the United States has its Navy there. And that's really it in a nutshell.
Right. We're maybe not considered a peacekeeping force, but our forces, just by being there, keep peace. When we look at the border with Mexico, we have a very long border that we don't have an organized military attacking over. We don't even really have an organization whose aim is the downfall of the U.S. government. So if you're thinking of like ISIS or Al-Qaeda, they had a stated goal of the downfall of the United States government. That sounds like a warlike approach. The president likes to say that there's an invasion on the southern border. If you want to call it an invasion, it doesn't meet the military definition. It looks much more like a migratory wave in an economics definition. And you can't stop migratory waves with the military. Or if you do, you're going to look like Turkey. And the Turks have been working hard at that, at stopping the Syrian migrations before hitting Europe. They've basically laid out their military to do it. So you've got hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people in refugee camps. That's the alternative. You got to have a refugee camp to stop a migratory wave if you want to stop it. That is kind of the key, is that the barrier only goes so far. Then you have to do something with the people that the barrier stops. Why is it our responsibility? It isn't. Well, unless we make it our responsibility.
We've done something with the, you know, about over half the border now has a barrier on it.
Right.
And we have done something with the people the barrier stops. We let them in at the ports and at the airports.
And document them, even if they're undocumented, right?
And then they stay here and overstay their visa. By the way, that's where the majority of illegal aliens come from.
Is overstayed visas.
Is they come in through airports.
Yeah, this isn't a wall issue. You would have to have a very, very tall wall to stop an airplane.
And the same thing is true of terrorist attacks and bombs and so on that we've stopped coming through.
Now, that doesn't make us anti-wall.
No, I'm just simply saying,
if we can find a way to pay for it, and there's a lot more to pay for than $5.7 billion, because it's eminent domain, and we just talked about Texas's property rights. There are a lot of property owners on the border. The majority of the border that we share with Mexico on our side of it is private property owned by U.S. citizens, and that wall is not going to meander with the river. It's going to cut straight lines, because that's how you build a cheap wall. That means they're going to cut off private property from people. It sounds like we're against the wall by saying all that. We're not.
Well,
we just like to understand what the consequences are of an action. The wall by itself is not the solution, but if it's a big enough, important enough thing for people,
then
do it, but pay for it. Pay for it appropriately.
Independent estimators have gone through and said how much that wall is probably going to cost.
Right.
Wall or fence or whatever you want to call it.
When eminent domain is talked about in the middle of it.
The big cost is not going to be the concrete to put up a wall. Or
the steel or whatever.
The big cost is going to be all the property that is taken, and including the courts have already ruled on several occasions that if you cut off a person from his property, the government has to buy it if the government uses eminent domain. And if that's true, then the wall across Texas would cost about $50 billion. Now,
it'll be one of the largest seizures of private property by the U.S. government on record.
But let's just say that we decide we want a wall. No problem. Congress then needs to pass a bill taxing, raising taxes over a reasonable period of time, let's say 5 years while the wall is being built, raising taxes $50 billion. In that case, I'll say, let's do the wall. But if the request, which is in the budget and other things, is let's just build a wall and borrow the money.
We're against that. That's certainly not, I mean, I'm totally for, in a war footing, to borrow money to pay for the military. But this isn't a war footing. It's easy to measure the crime on immigration and measure the cost associated with it. It's easy to measure these things. This is stuff put out by the Trump administration, because that's one of the jobs of government, is to measure this stuff. And when we look at the costs and what it would cost to put up a wall, it's going to take, it would never pay for itself. That is clearest we can say it. And Mexico's not going to pay for it. So if we're going to pay for it, let's discuss what the real price is.
And let's pay for it.
And let's pay for it. Not $5.7 billion. Use the real numbers. Say this is what the wall is going to cost.
But the last thing I want to do is say, let's build a wall and borrow the money from the Chinese.
Right. And that is effectively what we'll be doing if we do, because we're already borrowing this year, just this fiscal year, $1.3 trillion we're borrowing as a government. If we're going to put more money on that and borrow it from the Chinese and pay them interest on the wall, it makes it a lot harder for me to see this as palatable. This doesn't taste good to me. It's not been chewed up. It's not been disseminated properly. Treat this like a real goal. Inform the American public and get us on board if you're going to do it. And the government shutdown didn't get a lot of people on board, by the way. That had the reverse effect for a lot of people.
There's, frankly, I'll tell you what I'm in favor of. Take the $2 trillion that was already in the budget for security.
$2 trillion?
No, I mean $2
billion. $2 billion. Yeah, those B's, T's, they get mixed up. Yeah.
And apply it where at least part of it was supposed to go, which was recognizing that about 80% of those people who are in the United States illegally today came in by overstaying visas and just simply never left. But we don't have an effective method of tracking that. We don't have any system for tracking that. It would involve an expansion of government, yes. It would involve having a lot of folks out there working for the government that weren't working for the government to track these folks down. But right now, we have a section of immigration control that is virtually unfunded, where most illegal immigrants are coming in. And we have another section that is quite possibly overfunded at this point along the border. I don't know if you're aware of this, but the number of immigrants coming across the border has actually dropped dramatically over the last 10 years. So basically, let's apply it across the board if we want to control immigration. Let's apply it where we have our weakest points. Let's apply it where the smuggling is actually occurring, and not simply take a lot of money that should go to defend our country against illegal immigration and apply it to an area where it probably will be relatively ineffective and be the largest land grab the government has ever done under eminent domain.
No, it's not largest ever. It's just largest in the last couple 150 years or so.
In dollar
form, it's definitely the largest, even adjusted for inflation, because much of the land that was grabbed by the government and given to the corporations that ran the railroad, it was across unowned land most of the time.
Yeah, the government actually owned most of that land.
And that's why this is the largest land grab from private citizens, not the largest eminent domain, but the largest repurpose of private land to public land.
And very frankly,
unvoluntarily,
there's a lot of suggestions, by the way, that even if we got the full funding for the border wall, it still would never go up. And the reason it would never go up is it would never pass court muster in the state of Texas, because Texas, we have tremendously protective property rights, and the government has to prove to a court before they can take your land that it is in the best, not just that the law is passed that they can take your land, but this is the most effective use that can be used for that land, which is why we don't have uh, a, turnpike system running up through east of I-35 right now because people said you may pass a law saying you are exercising eminent domain, but we're not going to put up with it.
And there's another piece of this that's hard for people to understand because it goes back pre-Constitution. There's still chunks of land on the border and up even in Salado that are illegal to be seized through eminent domain. And people say, what? How is that possible? Anybody can have their land seized. No, not if it was gifted to the family that still owns it by another country when the land was run by that country. Spanish land grants, Mexican land grants, those are free from eminent domain. If you're driving through Salado and you notice on I-35 that there's a curve in the highway there, it kind of zigs and zags a little bit. It's because it's going around the old Robertson land grant. This is property that its title goes back to governments that no longer exist, but it's pre-Constitution. All of this stuff is stuff that is important to know if we're talking about building a wall. It's not a slogan as soon as it becomes policy. And that's my problem with this government shutdown that has just ended. It isn't with the president. It isn't with Nancy Pelosi, although I've got problems with both of them. It's directly with, if you're trying to sell something to the American public, we are on the hook to pay for it. There may or may not be a threat associated with it. That's something that the case I'm not fully sold on. Tell us the truth on the cost. Tell us who's going to pay for it and how. And at this point, I haven't heard that. I haven't heard it from anybody. And that causes me to dig my heels in a little bit, and maybe more than a little bit. I mean, we're talking about it now. And what does this have to do with the economy? A lot. We're looking at the economics of a wall. The economics of building concrete or steel involve importing a bunch of that stuff from Mexico because we still only produce 70% of our steel in the United States, and we are at capacity on concrete manufacturing. We buy a lot of our concrete from Carlos Slim's companies in Mexico.
Well, in the United States.
Yeah, and in the United States. So it's kind of like Venezuela. If you really don't like them, don't buy their gasoline anymore. And if you don't know which gas stations are theirs, I'm not going to tell you. Look it up. It's public information. If you don't like Maduro, then don't buy his gasoline. You're supporting his government when you do it. This is one of those things that I think people need to effectively focus their mind. If they really believe as strongly as they think they do on political areas, they need to do their own research in it. Look at it and say, is this true? Is this effective? Is this the best solution? That's how good government works. And this type of government solution is what drives good people out of government, because it's not about truth. It's about the shortest soundbite or the most campaign promises that can be met without regard to whether they're good promises. Go ahead.
Well, I have something I want to completely change the subject on.
Good.
But we probably ought to do commercials.
Let's do that. Do you want to give us a teaser as to what we're going to be talking about?
Well, Elizabeth Warren has come up with an idea for a wealth tax.
Yeah.
And I'd like to discuss that.
Don't
judge it. Just
I'm not gonna judge it. We'll go ahead with the commercials. We'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. If you'd like to join the conversation, the phone number in here is 254-773-1400. We'll be back.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. Telephone number in here remains 254-773-1400, presuming that this is January 26th. We're running out of January here.
Yeah, almost done with it.
I think we should extend it.
We'll do a repeat next year.
Okay, that's good. What I wanted to bring up, and I wanted to hear some comments from the public if you're interested in commenting, is Elizabeth Warren has figured out how to pay for the tax cuts.
By raising taxes.
But
that's not
leaving the income tax cuts in place and putting a 1% tax on household net worth above a billion. No, 2%, I'm sorry, 2% above a billion. And then if you go above, what was it, 10 billion? For if you're above 50, okay, I'm sorry.
Above 50
it's
million.
It's 2% above 50 million, an additional 1% tax on wealth above 1 billion.
So that's a 3% tax
yeah,
on.
Yeah, so that would affect 75,000 households, which is 0.01% of the population, and would raise $2.75 trillion over the next decade, which would more than pay for the income tax cuts.
Yeah, it just would cause large corporations to be worth less than they are, though. That's a problem. We have a caller on 773-1400. We've got to complete this conversation in a moment. But caller on 773-1400, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Oops. Well, the question, you know, and if anybody wants to call in and comment on this, I'd be interested in hearing it. It's, you know, it. I'm not saying that I support it. I don't. But it's an interesting way of saying there is a huge income disparity in the United States right now. It's one of the larger ones we've had in history, not the largest, but it's up there. Certainly the largest one we've had in about 100 years. And the issue is, what do you think about the idea that taking, if you have over $50 million of net worth, you pay a 1%, in essence, property tax on it?
It's an extra tax. And I look at that, and it's an extra tax. So
or
2%. Yeah, that's what her proposal
50
is,
million,
2%.
2%, yeah.
My problem with it is the same problem I have with property taxes in general. If someone owns a lot, so we'll use the richest guy in the world. Okay, so Jeff Bezos owns the Washington Post, owns Amazon, or a big chunk of Amazon. He doesn't have a lot of cash. I mean, he's got more cash than your standard. You know,
I bet he's got more cash than I do.
He's got more cash than I do, but he doesn't have enough cash for 2% of his wealth. And that wealth fluctuates drastically with the market. If Amazon takes a hit, or if we're looking at Facebook and Mark Zuckerberg's wealth, if Facebook takes a hit, his net worth, Zuckerberg, is about $57 billion. If there's a 3% tax on his wealth, he owes $1.7 billion. He's never sold that much Facebook. If every year he's required to sell something like that, it's going to affect the price of Facebook. It may affect his control of Facebook.
And then, of course,
it creates a situation where he no longer might be CEO if he loses enough control. And that's my problem with it, is that unless there's cash on hand to pay for this, it could destroy a business. So,
well, one of the things obviously you got to take into account is that if he were to sell $1.6 billion worth of Facebook, he would have taxes on the sale.
Yeah. Capital gains taxes on the sale, so that he could then turn around and use the proceeds of that to pay the other tax. That's a problem. You're not going to hear me weeping over a billionaire's tax bill. But I would like to see an effective tax bill, just like I would like to see an effective wall project. Do it the right way. Talk about what the costs are and what the production is and how the money's going to show up, all of that stuff. And the problem with property taxes, if you think of somebody with a fixed income that has a nice house and their goal in retirement was to have their house paid for by the time they retired, we in Texas have recognized that if you're a senior citizen, you at least have that tax rate capped on your property taxes.
You have it frozen. But
you have it frozen.
Doesn't go up.
Right.
But you still pay on it.
Yeah, you're still paying on it. But again, this is one of those areas where it's caused people to have to sell property that they never wanted to sell versus, income tax. I don't think that's the best method either, but it's better than property tax. Well, I think a sales tax is the appropriate way. But if you have a sales tax at the national level, I wouldn't be comfortable with that without a complete abolishing of the income tax. So then you just have both, and then we're in California or New York. No thanks.
Well, what do you think? We got a $1.5 trillion, $1.5 trillion deficit this year.
Yeah.
The government spending is not going to be cut significantly because
too many people like the pork.
Well, it's not just the pork.
Entitlements are pork too.
Well, I don't know. I've paid into Social Security all my life.
Sure.
And I am a long ways from getting back as much as I paid in.
So absolutely.
Somebody proposes that I get back less than I paid in.
That's pork.
I wouldn't call it pork.
Entitled to it. You know this concept of having paid in.
If I pay into whether it's an insurance company or a bank or the federal government, if I pay in for 60 years or 55 years, with them agreeing that they will pay me a certain amount of money as long as I live, after I'm 66 in this case.
Yeah.
Do you think it's appropriate that they should cut that?
I think it's appropriate that we should start talking about this as a problem, because here's the other reality, the piece that you're missing. Entitlement mentality is, I want to get mine. The reality is that if you get yours, I don't get mine.
That's not necessarily true.
Well, there have to be some big changes, and I won't get the same thing that I was promised when I started paying in.
Why not?
Because you didn't get the thing that you were promised when you were paying in. Your full retirement age got moved up.
Sure.
So have you voted a problem with?
And I voted for the people who did that, and it came through fairly. Now,
yeah. So the point that I'm saying is this gives back the first investors the money. It is more like a Ponzi scheme than a real investment.
Wait a minute. I'm not suggesting that you don't get Social Security. I'm suggesting that the Social Security system works pretty well, and it would only take some minor tweaks to the Social Security system so you get your full Social Security.
Yeah, well, no, it'd take some minor tweaks to the Social Security system to means test me out of it.
No, so it's not necessarily.
If you look at your income compared to somebody that's subsisting on Social Security.
Mine's higher.
Yeah. So if this is a social program, Social Security is socialist. And it's an entitlement, and everybody is due, except that's not what it was originally intended for. It was intended to save as a safety net for retirees who had nothing. And it's become a retirement plan for everyone. And when it was instituted as a retirement plan for everyone, there were 32 workers per retiree, and now there's two.
There was never any means test at the beginning, so it was never intended to pay only poor people.
You're right. It was not intended immediately to only pay poor people, but they did have a shorter life expectancy and there were a lot more workers.
So my point is that Social Security could be easily fixed. I would be willing to pay more in Social Security taxes so you could have Social Security. That's a solution.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's a proper solution for the government to, in effect, set up a contract with its citizens and say, you pay in this much for this period of time, and then we will pay you in return a certain amount of money, and then renege on that contract. And we have a caller on 773-1400. Caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Go ahead, caller. It's going great.
Would like for you to comment on whether we could do away with income tax and make it on a sales tax.
We have a disagreement on that.
I think as a tax system, it would be a better tax system if you could actually do it. The problem is that it removes the power from Congress. Congress gets to tweak the tax code to say if you make this much money or if you're in this kind of a business or in that kind of a business or that one over there, you get taxed at different rates. And a sales tax is kind of on the part of the merchant that collects the tax. And they would have to ask a lot of questions from you when you came in as to what kind of business you have and all that stuff in order to tax you differently than if you were just buying it. So it removes a lot of the power from Congress, and I think that's the biggest headwind.
Well, I think the biggest headwind is, and this I've read over and over again, was it 15% roughly is what it would take, a 15% sales tax? I think that was the last number.
It'd be 15.4.
Okay,
yeah.
So if all of a sudden the price of everything out there jumps 15%, would that affect your tendency to buy the things? For instance, if the price of a car went up 15% over what it was last year, would you be less likely to buy the car? Caller.
Probably not.
Okay. Well, I think most people
particularly lower income people might find themselves in the position of saying, if prices jump that much, we're just not going to buy.
We've got enough data, though, as economists. We got enough data when states and countries leave an income tax system and go to a sales tax system that prices don't go up.
What?
If the
where have they done that?
The Brazil started it. The, Texas is an example of where income taxes have been removed mm-hmm. from specific municipalities. And we don't see prices go up there because the revenue is neutral. The prices are raised right now because taxes have to be paid on them. And when we see, if we see a tax cut causing profitability to cause prices to go down, that's an example of how an income tax cut at the same time as a sales tax going, you would know what you were spending right away.
The other thing that that bugs me about the simple tax, the sales tax system, is in order to keep it from disproportionately hitting poor people, and it would hit them hard.
You have to pay a check out every month.
Basically, most of the United States population would be receiving, actually 100% of the United States population would be receiving a check every month from the federal government to offset sales taxes, which seems to me like when you have the entire nation, everybody in the nation, requiring in order to get by to receive income from the be paid by the federal government, so you have to be taxed, it go to the federal government, and then the government return it to you every month in a paycheck.
Over 40% right now receive more from the federal government than they give in, and over 50% are receiving more through all programs than what they pay in taxes.
So we've got
54%, well over the majority limit now, that the current tax code is paying them money.
But they
it's just not in a check.
They pay them once a year and not very much.
Well, depends on how you
measure
that.
Because they don't
pay
the income taxes to begin with. So
depends on how they pay it in, and then it comes back. And that's the thing, is that Social Security and entitlement taxes don't come back to them. They're still net, if you count all the taxes, paying more in, except that the entitlement says that they're expecting it back, too, at some point in their retirement.
Anyway, does that answer your question? I mean, could we do it?
Yeah,
but I don't think it's going to happen.
I would love it to happen.
For several reasons, one of which is Brazil went from an income tax to a sales tax or a value-added tax?
They did a value-added tax.
Okay, now value-added tax, I'll say, that would work. But I don't think a sales tax would work.
Any type of tax that is related to sales is generalized as a sales tax. Any type of tax that is related to income is called an income tax. So we're talking about a big category.
In other words,
and value added falls in the sales.
One of the things that bothers me about sales tax is you see something for sale. Let's say it's $1,000 or let's say it's $100. And you go say, okay, I've got $100. I can pay for that. And then you go to pay for it. And let's just put us in the state of Texas. We have an 8.5% sales tax plus a 15% government sales tax. Basically, it's going to be around a 25% surcharge on the item that you're purchasing. So instead of paying $100 for it, you're going to pay $125 for it. The advertised price is $100, but you get to pay $125. To me, that puts it over the top to the point where I probably wouldn't buy it. And because of that, I think we'd see a slowdown in the economy and a fall off in tax revenue and probably a recession.
And the thing is that it's never been done on a large enough scale to know what really happens to prices. So it's a big unknown. And that's the other headwind, is that if you don't know what the economy is going to do with a given tax, it's going
to
be rough.
Probably ought not to use it.
Yeah, it's going to be rough. I would do it at selective modes, start in certain states, but then you're going to see mass migrations, just like when Massachusetts did their own version of the Affordable Care Act and people started moving. The first year it was really effective, everything looked great, and then the second year things got really, really rocky because a lot of people were moving or crossing borders. So I hope that answered it, caller.